on and unmuted. Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Annette. I can't hear Pat.
Right. Pat, you must be muted. Good morning, Attorney Harrison. We're waiting for one more attorney to join us.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Attorney Roth. You're probably a pro at this now, since it's your second oral argument. Just for your participation, perhaps more equally, you will see Attorney Harrison in the box that says Supreme Court Hearing Room, where there's a picture of our hearing room. You will find a timer there, and it will say start, which will occur right after I ask the argument to begin, and then you'll get a five-minute warning that's in green, and then a red stop. So you'll have to keep your eye on that just a little bit. I think we are all assembled now, so I will call our second case of the morning, Wisconsin Small Business United, Inc. versus Brennan. Attorney Harrison, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Kendall Harrison, appearing this morning on behalf of Wisconsin Small Businesses United and the individual taxpayer petitioner. I want to acknowledge that if we have been fortunate enough to be in the courtroom today, my two colleagues, Mike Wittenweiler and Zach Lehman, will be there sitting with me at the council table. They're watching on Zoom like everybody else right now. Let me begin by recognizing the case raises a narrower question, one that can be answered based upon existing precedent and on a careful examination of the 1990 amendment. And the question in this case is this. Does the governor have the constitutional authority to create a new date in an appropriation bill by striking digits in the original date? We know, based upon the 1990 amendment, that the governor could not create new words in an appropriation bill by striking letters. And because dates are a collection of words consisting of the day, the month, and the year, that means if the legislature chooses to write out a date entirely in letters, the governor can't strike any of those letters to create a new date. And the issue here is whether the result should be any different if the legislature represents a date not just in letters, but in letters and digits, as it did here. Our position is that there's no difference. Respondents say that there is.
Counsel, in at least a couple of vetoes in Thompson involved some striking of digits, you know, one took a calendar year 87, 88, and 88, 89, and made it one whole biennium, you know, 87 to 89. Would accepting your argument require some overturning or modification of Thompson in any way? Yeah.
That's a very good question, Justice Hagedorn. I think the place to begin there is by, first of all, recognizing that Attorney Roth, during his oral argument earlier this morning, suggested that the 1990 amendment was simply a ratification of this court's prior case law. It absolutely was not. The 1990 amendment was a rejection of this court's decision in the Thompson case. The amendment came together in a matter of approximately 2 weeks after that decision and passed overwhelmingly by the voters of this state. And if you look at what the discussion was in Thompson and what the discussion has been of the partial veto powers since then in both Cub and in Risser, I think it breaks down like this. In an appropriation bill, you essentially have two categories. You have dollar words, concepts relate to dollars, and then you have non-dollar words. Within the dollars, you have a further breakdown into appropriation dollars and non-appropriation dollars. What the court said in Cub was that appropriation dollars are where the governor's powers are at their zenith. That's the core, I think, is what the governor's counsel and Cub said during oral argument. That's the governor's strongest point. And so as a result of that, we are going to allow the governor to both exercise a digit veto and to exercise a write-in veto. Then when we moved to Risser, the court was asked whether that also applies to non-appropriation dollar amounts in appropriation bills. And what the court said there was that the governor still has the ability to use a digit veto to strike through non-appropriation sums and reduce them, but his powers are not as strong as with respect to an appropriation bill, so he doesn't have the ability to exercise a write-in veto. So then that brings us to the non-dollar words, and what we're faced with here, I think, is the next case, the next logical case. And the court is being asked to determine whether or not, with respect to that non-dollar amount category, whether this governor should have the ability to strike through either digits or letters with respect to those non-dollar amounts, like dates, and effectuate policy. And our position, of course, is that the governor does not have the ability to do that. So, to answer your question, I realize that was a little long, but I wanted to set out that sort of taxonomy first because I think it's helpful to the rest of this discussion. To answer your question, the people of this state already overruled, in a sense, some of the things that the court had done in Wisconsin Senate.
Counsel, do I understand your argument correctly that more than just the date was changed, but a statute that was already in place was essentially kind of vetoed after the fact? In other words, it had been passed before, and then by changing the date out so many years, essentially what was vetoed was not a new part of the appropriation bill.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, as you know, we're challenging two different vetoes.
Yes.
One of them relates to something we've been calling the Energy Efficiency Program. And with that one, the legislature had decided to have a moratorium on that law, which had been already in effect for a couple years. But under the language of the enrolled bill, that law was going to be subject to a moratorium that would end on December 31st of 2018. And what the governor did with that veto was to take his veto pen and to strike out the one, the comma, and the two, and then knit back together the remaining pieces to create the new word of December 3018. 3018 was the new word there. And obviously, the effect of that is dramatic. Basically, the moratorium went from a one-year moratorium to a 1,000-year moratorium. And we think that that's inappropriate. Same thing with respect to the bad debt deduction. That one is a little bit more complicated because there was existing law as to whether when that was going to take effect. Existing law said that that would take effect on July 1 of 2017. The legislature then, with the budget bill, decided to have that law take effect on July 1 of 2018. The governor struck a number of things, the result of which was to make the effective date of that law July 1 of 2078, 60 years into the future.
In direct response to what Chief Justice Rosenstock asked, these weren't laws that were already in effect. This put off, in one case, the moratorium, and in the other case, the effective date of the law, correct?
The laws had already been passed, and what the legislature was changing with the budget bill was simply when those laws would essentially become effective. One was the effective date, one was the end of the moratorium.
Right, but passed, but not yet in effect. Just as any other provision in those budget bills could have already passed, but
The Energy Efficiency Program had already been in effect. The bad debt deduction had not been.
Okay, and in effect how? Was that moratorium in effect at the time and this extended the moratorium?
I believe, I might get the date slightly wrong here, but I believe that the Energy Efficiency Program was passed into law in 2013 and then had been in effect for several years. And then with the budget bill, there was going to be essentially a one-year moratorium on the law.
So that moratorium never went into effect is all that happened. I mean, if this matters, we're talking about the difference between changing a pre-existing law, which is what I think the Chief Justice was asking about, versus any other type of appropriation piece that was vetoed. And what the way I understand it is, this didn't effectively change anything already in effect.
Well, I thought that was my question, and I thought what he identified is that the energy part of the two vetoes had been in effect since 2013. It wasn't vetoed, but the legislature decided to take a break on it, or a moratorium, as he called it. And what the governor did is to make that a 1,000-year break instead of a one-year break? Am I correct? I just want to be sure I have
That's correct, Your Honor. That's exactly what happened here. I think in discussing this case, it's important to recognize that both of these vetoes involve dates And so it's important to discuss what a date is. And I touched on it just a moment ago. But if you look at a date is simply a point in time. And that point in time can, it's a day, a month, and a year. And the day, the month, and the year that make up a date, that can be represented in a whole variety of different fashions, right? You could have that date spelled out entirely in letters, say July 4th, 1776, all in letters. You could have that represented entirely in digits, 7/4/1776. Or you could represent that date like it was, the dates were represented here, with letters, July, and then digits, 4 and the 1776. But no matter, you know, what symbols are used to represent the date is still the same point in time, no matter how it's represented. Any date is composed of those three words, a day, a month, and a year. And we know, as I said in the outset, if the legislature had written out these dates entirely in letters, the 1990 amendment clearly prohibits the governor from being able to strike any of those letters to create a new date. So to take the energy efficiency program and the December 31st, 2018 date, if that was all written out in letters, I think even the respondents in this instance would agree that the governor couldn't strike those out to create the new word of 3018, which the governor created by that veto.
Would that same reasoning, counsel, couldn't the numbers be written out too? I mean, a number is certainly capable of being written into words as opposed to numbers.
Well, I want to be precise here because I think I'm not sure if your question gets at whether words can include both digits and letters. Obviously, our position and the definition that we gave you from Merriam-Webster's is broad enough that a word includes both letters and digits. So I don't think there's a distinction to be made there. In this instance, the 1990 amendment prohibits the governor from creating new words, and he created two new words with these vetoes. One was 3018. And one was 2078.
But under your reasoning, then anytime he changes an appropriation number, he's creating a new word also if he chose to spell it out as a word, right?
No, and let me segue back to the taxonomy that I set up before, because I think that this is crucial to understanding the position that we're advancing in this case. The governor has the ability with monetary amounts to exercise a digit veto, whether with respect to an appropriation or a non-appropriation amount. And whether that is spelled out in letters or in digits, the governor still retains that power after the 1990 amendment. That's precisely what this court said in Cobb. If you look at Cobb, that was a situation in which the governor was faced with an appropriation amount of $350,000. And what he did was he struck out the entire $350,000 and wrote in $250,000. All of that, the $350,000 in that instance, was written out in digits. But this court was very careful to say that even if the legislature had written that amount out in letters, the governor would still have the ability to strike that out and write in $250,000. So if you think about the implication of that for this case, if the 1990 amendment doesn't prohibit that, it has the logical implication of supporting our position here. The idea being that if the governor can basically strike out the letters in when it's written out, he should be able to do the same thing here. The governor's counsel in the oral argument during Cobb said much the same thing that the court itself later said in its subsequent decision, and this court picked up on that even further in Risser. But that's another good example here of what the 1990 amendment allows and what it doesn't allow. So the governor's counsel there was talking about the concept of 15 days. Again, I'm putting that in my category of non-monetary amounts. So what he said was that we know that because of the 1990 amendment, if 15 days is written out in letters, the governor can't strike out those letters to create, you know, the new word of 10 days instead. And then he went on to admit, and this is the governor's own attorney, that because that's the case, the same principle should apply if the legislature had written out 15 days with the digits 1 and 5. The same idea, the same substance over form approach would prevent the governor from being able to strike out the 1 and the 5, just like he would be prevented from striking out the letters, which of course then segues back to kind of the broader understanding of the 1990 amendment. I just gave you the example of what the court did in Cobb and what the governor's own attorney said in Cobb. Both of those positions are the substance over form type of positions that we're advancing in this case. Respondent's position is that those are wrong because they're not tethered carefully enough to the text of the 1990 amendment, and they point out that the 1990 amendment talks only about letters. But of course, this court has already taken a more practical approach and recognized, yes, while it says letters, at least with respect to monetary amounts, it's not really limited by that. The governor still has the ability to strike digits and to do a write-in veto with monetary amounts. And we're simply saying that the 1990 amendment, when you look at respondents' position, that their textual argument is not advanced enough, that it stops. They want the court to stop at the text of the Constitution, and they don't want you to look at a broader contextual analysis of what that 1990 amendment was designed to do. The 1990 amendment was a direct response to this court's finding in the Thompson case that the governor had too much authority on the basis of that decision.
Counsel, can we talk about the lashes issue for a moment, please? You made an argument in your brief that this is a substantive, not procedural challenge. But I guess that, like you to try to persuade me better than you did in your brief on that one. Seems to me that this is challenging whether the bill has become a law, how it becomes a law, rather than the merits of it one way or the other because it violates some other constitutional provision. So that's the first piece. Let me ask a second question. I'll give you an opportunity to hit the bill. The second is, why just more broadly, why isn't lashes appropriate here, and what is the guard against, regardless of what the line should be, what is the guard against going back in time 10, 20, 30, 50 years in hearing a case? And do you think generally lashes can be applied in these cases?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. It gives me an opportunity to address a subject that I wanted to talk about today. I'll take your first question first. Give me the first question again, Your Honor. Sorry.
Yeah, I guess that's a danger of me asking too many questions at once. Sorry about that. The first question
is... substantive versus procedural. Yeah.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, Your Honor, with the substantive versus procedural debate, I think we could spend a lot of time going back and forth on whether this is a substantive or a procedural challenge. We say that it's substantive as a result of the fact that we are challenging issues that go to the very core of this state's constitution and what the proper lines are between the governor's authority and the legislature's authority. To answer your other question about whether and when lashes should apply, you could certainly envision a situation in which lashes would apply to bar a partial veto challenge. One example would be with respect to a monetary appropriation. If the legislature 20 years ago, let's say, had appropriated a certain amount of money to be spent, and that money then had gone out the door and was already used for the purposes which the legislature designed it for, it would be hard to imagine that you could come back 20 years and say that would be appropriate at that point in time to challenge that. The same point might hold with respect to, for example, the Winebow situation that respondents brought up in their brief. I don't have a total answer to whether Latches would bar the Winebow example or not, but I could certainly understand respondents' position that, 20 years is too long and that decisions have been made based upon the court's ruling in that case, and it's too late to go back and do anything about it now. But this is not that. We're not talking about appropriations. We are talking about non-monetary dates that have an impact of 60 years in one instance and 1,000 years in another instance. And I think that's just entirely a different situation.
But, counsel, wouldn't these monies have been spent but for the delays effectuated by the vetoes? I mean, didn't you run into some similar problem? Money shouldn't have been spent.
I don't think so, Your Honor. We're talking about a two-year period. It was roughly 2 years between the time that the vetoes were made and that we filed suit. And by comparison to the length of time that these vetoes are going to be in effect, it's nothing. So, respondents, one of the things they say is that it was unreasonable for us to bring the suit when we did. I don't think that's the case. And I also don't think it's the case that they really have suffered any prejudice. Two things which they actually need to show to prove latches, and of course, as this court knows, even if the respondents had met their burden on latches, which they haven't, this court still has the discretion as to whether and when to apply latches. And here, there's no good reason to apply latches. This court is already looking at partial veto powers of the governor in the Bartlett case. We've raised, I think, significant questions about the interpretation of the 1990 amendment. And the time to address those questions is ripe, and the time to resolve those is now. And obviously, we think that the court should be setting the boundaries between the branches exactly where the people of this state wanted them to be set in 1990 with that amendment. So, Your Honors, just to sum up, I think it's worth going back again to Mr. Ross' point that the 1990 amendment was simply designed to ratify all the decisions that this court has already issued. That clearly is wrong. The 1990 amendment was about imposing some limits on the governor's power. And yes, Mr. Ross is right that it wasn't eliminating the partial veto altogether. It was preserving the governor's ability to make digit vetoes, have a write-in veto with respect to dollar amounts. But it basically said that the Vanna White vetoes, the pickle letter vetoes that the court had blessed in Wisconsin Senate was a bridge too far. And it said no. And this court should enforce and honor the intent of those voters in this case.
Counsel, we have a effective date of 1,000 years, which seems a long time to me. But what if the effective date by a governor was within the one-year moratorium, changing the 1 year to a half year? How do you respond to that fact situation?
Yeah, it's a good question, Justice Bradley. Our proposed rule in this case would treat them the same. Basically, what we're saying is that the effects of this particular veto were extreme. Obviously, 1,000 years is something that nobody can even contemplate the legislature doing, and it's laughable in some senses, except for the very real world impacts of it.
As I understand it, your argument advanced covers all dates, whether it's
the argument is essentially that the a governor cannot create. I see that my time has elapsed.
You can just answer Justice Bradley's question. Yes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the date is going to be one that it doesn't matter whether the time frame is within the year or beyond the year. What matters
is whether the governor has created a new date, a new word. And that's precisely what he has done with these vetoes, which go 1,000 years into the future. And it would be a new date, a new point in time, if the governor had chosen something earlier in December of 2018 as well. It doesn't make a difference one way or the other.
Thank you very much. Attorney Roth, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, good afternoon, Your Honors. Again, Assistant Attorney General Colin Roth here on behalf of the respondents. I think petitioners lose this case under either the equitable laches doctrine or on the merits. With respect to laches, I think these petitioners simply waited too long to challenge these partial vetoes from Governor Walker's 2017 biennial budget. I didn't hear any real answer to the many problems I think that would arise if provisions in past budget bills, maybe even those dating back decades, become subject to challenges like these. I think it prejudices not only the governor, who should have predictability when crafting a budget, but the legislature, who needs the same. And I think it also prejudices the private sector, individuals, again, all of whom rely on predictability in public policy when crafting their affairs. On the merits, I think, again, this is a relatively simple case. I think the constitutional text and this court's case law mean that they lose. I think in Thompson, this court clearly upheld digit vetoes that are not meaningfully different from those here. And I think petitioners really concede that point. And so as I understand it, their sole argument here today really turns on the effect of the 1990 amendment. And I think that argument is dead on arrival, given how the 1990 amendment was phrased.
Counsel, what interests me most is an argument that was made by opposing counsel that the governor's veto for the energy part of these two vetoes really set aside a law that was already operable since 2013. And I don't recall your addressing that issue at all in your brief, and it was the one that interests me most. So perhaps you can do so now.
Sure. I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is I would point, Your Honor, to Thompson, which itself dealt with exactly this kind of veto that Your Honor is concerned about. If you read Thompson, one of the 37 vetoes at issue was a provision that originally read, I don't recall exactly what section, we'll call it Section X. It said Section X is repealed and recreated to read, and then the bill had a new version of that section. And what the governor did in Thompson, what Governor Thompson did, was delete everything in that provision that came after the word repealed. And so after Governor Thompson's partial veto, that section in the budget bill simply read, Section X is repealed. And again, that was a statutory section that had been in effect prior to the biennial budget bill that Governor Thompson was considering. And so the court in Thompson expressly addressed that veto and said, look, we see no basis in the constitutional text, which allows the governor to approve any part of an appropriation bill, to forbid this kind of veto. Essentially, we don't look at the effects of the veto. We look at whether the veto complied with the text.
And so in addition to Thompson, don't we also have to consider what occurred here in light of the constitutional amendment that followed Thompson?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I agree with that completely. I would just add, and I think we'll get to the 1990 amendment in just a minute, but the second point I'd like to add is that when Governor Walker considered the two provisions here, he was considering moratoriums and extensions of the effective date of these two provisions that the legislature itself decided to include in the bill. So I think it's critical to realize that Governor Walker did not just create a moratorium out of thin air. He did not create an extension of the effective date out of thin air. These were items that the legislature put on the table.
But he essentially vetoed
an enactment that had been in place since 2013. If you're going to push it out 1,000 years, that's permitting him to veto a law that was already in place and not part of the budget bill initially.
Well, again, Your Honor, I'd emphasize that Thompson approved precisely. I think, you know, I think Justice Hagedorn really, really cut to the core of the issue. I don't see anything in the petitioner's response on latches that helps this court decide when one of these challenges is simply too late. And I think the easy line to draw that makes the most sense in this case, and frankly any partial veto case, is that a challenge should be brought within the biennium in which the bill it's challenging was signed. And that's what has always happened. I mean, this court...
Counsel, just a question. Do we need to decide what the end date is necessarily when it's done? I mean, Fascia's cases are pretty fact-specific. And there was an argument in response to your argument in the reply brief that, hey, even June 30th would have been after the new budget's been proposed and, you know, adopted by each chamber, maybe before it was signed into law. So that doesn't get you much either. I guess I'm wondering whether we need to buy the end of the biennium as a firm line, even if your argument lashes is ultimately.
Sure. So two answers to that. The first is, of course, latches is a fact-specific analysis, and this court's free to just decide this case on its facts and not draw a clear line. I think respondents offered that test as one that could provide some additional stability and predictability to these kinds of cases, but of course, it is a fact-specific analysis and could be decided for this case only. But I do think, and just very briefly, I do think even challenges brought on June 30th would provide a crucial information to the governor. Perhaps the challenge would not be resolved by the time he needs to sign a bill, but he would at least know that some portions of his or her, obviously, upcoming budget bill are subject to challenge and are uncertain and could respond accordingly before he signs the bill. So again, I think a challenge brought during the biennium provides important information to the governor. But the last thing I would say is the reason respondents proposed that line, I think, applies to most of these kinds of cases that you would see. And the reason for that is, you know, I think if you look at the two provisions at issue here, it's a tax deduction and a local school district revenue limit. When crafting a new budget, it's critical to have reliable estimates of revenue. This tax deduction could blow an estimated $10 million hole in revenue projections for every fiscal year. It's $20 million over the biennium. That's not an insubstantial amount of money that would all of a sudden disappear. I think the governor has the right and, frankly, the obligation to craft budget bills on a predictable level of revenue. And if you can't do that, you know, our analysis is very difficult to do. And it's the same with the property tax provision. Again, it's a revenue limit on how much local school districts can exceed their levies, which has a direct impact on local property taxes. And I think if you look at this provision, school districts across the state were, where I think it was up to $80 million, they were exceeding their revenue limits. And much of that was concentrated in three school districts. I think it was Green Bay, Racine, and one other. Those are meaningful property tax increases for individual homeowners and businesses. And so I think when the governor is receiving a budget, one of his or her jobs is to decide whether property tax relief should be included in the budget. And not knowing whether that this revenue limit was going to be subject to a challenge, Governor Evers never had the chance to consider whether property tax relief should have been included. And so I think these are the kinds of things that are going to arise really any time you have a challenge to a partial veto that occurs after the biennium has ended. There are always going to be these assumptions that are upset that I think the governor and, like I said, also the legislature and private parties should have certainty on when they're crafting a new budget. And I think, again, this is very different from, and I think, Justice Hagedorn, again, you put your finger on it, this is not a substantive challenge in the sense that you know, this property tax deduction somehow conflicts with the Constitution itself on its substance. This is simply a challenge to the procedure by which the law was enacted. And substantive challenges, I would concede, it's a much different latches analysis. Of course, we can't leave provisions on the books that conflict with, say, the Equal Protection Clause or you know, whatever. But when it's simply a challenge to the procedure by which the bill was enacted, I think it's very important that those are brought promptly. So that's really all I have to say about latches. But again, you know, going back to the merits of this issue, I think it's very clear that from this court's case law, which again, I don't think that the petitioners challenge any of it, that digit vetoes are permissible. And by digit vetoes, I think what this court has always understood that to mean are the deletion of digits in the budget bill. That was at issue in Thompson. The court said okay. And even after the 1990 amendment was passed, in CUV and Risser, the court again said that digit vetoes were permissible. And again, it emphasized that those digit vetoes, simple deletions of digits, are different from write-ins, where this more conceptual analysis is required. And so I think when you consider those facts, again, Thompson, the 1990 amendment, and the cases after Thompson, all of which emphasize that digit vetoes are okay, I think that resolves this case. And I think that really the last thing that I would have to say on this is I can't emphasize enough that if this court really has heartburn over the 1,000-year moratorium and simply thinks that goes too far, I think it needs to be very careful not to disturb the many other digit vetoes that are nothing like that and accomplish much more modest changes to bills that the legislature sends. And I guess the last thing I'd say is, you know, I think petitioners really sort of need to twist themselves into knots to explain why digits within appropriation bills can be deleted under CUB and RISR, but digits in appropriation amounts, dollar figures, appropriation dollar figures, why those are okay to delete, but digits within other kinds of numbers are not.
I think their argument, counsel, is the dates are, I think they call them non-dollar words, correct? So they parse the digit veto and the number veto into non-dollar words and dollar words. And I don't think they're trying to attack a digit veto in a dollar word. They're trying to attack digit vetoes in non-dollar words, which is how you fall into dates and outside of the dollar appropriations.
Sure, and I agree with that this is the distinction that they're trying to draw. My point is that ultimately this question must be answered by, again, examining the text of Article 5, Section 10. And for them to draw this distinction between dollar words and non-dollar words, I think there needs to be a textual basis for doing so. Again, this court's framework of analysis has always been the correct one. It's you start with the text and follow where it leads us. And I think when you do that here, the only conclusion you can draw is that there's no difference between digits in dollar words and non-dollar words. I simply don't see a basis for drawing that distinction anywhere in the text of the Constitution. Would it be sensible, perhaps, on a blank slate to have that kind of distinction and to craft a constitutional provision that makes that distinction? Perhaps. But I don't think that's the question we're here today to answer. Again, and this goes for Bartlett, too. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the question this court has to ask is what is the text that we have, not what is the text that we might wish we had. I think those are two very different questions. And in this case, I think the answer is clear that the text we have allows the governor to delete digits. That goes for digits in dollar amounts, and that goes for digits in non-dollar amounts. If the people don't like that rule, if they don't like that implication of the text that they've chosen, they are, of course, free to change it. And obviously they've done so twice recently, and they can do so again. And I think that's the only way to reach the result that petitioners here are requesting. Thank you, Your Honors. That's all I have.
I forgot my mute was on. Attorney Harrison, I was calling you, but you couldn't hear me. Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin with laches. As both Justice Hagedorn and Mr. Roth just acknowledged, laches is a facts and circumstances type of analysis that depends upon the particular circumstances of each case. It's not an appropriate place with an equitable doctrine like laches for the hard and fast rule that respondents are proposing here. They need to establish that there was some sort of unreasonable delay and that there was some sort of prejudice, and they haven't done either of those things. They also haven't given a persuasive explanation as to why it is that this court should exercise its discretion in this case to refuse to hear the very weighty constitutional issues that we've put before you. Their explanation on the prejudice is that they have not been able to address the effects of not having a $10 million coming in a particular year. When you compare that to the $81 billion budget, it's something like 1/1000th of a percent. So it strains credulity a little bit to suggest that that made a huge difference to Governor Walker's budget. Moreover, on the prejudice point, the respondents in this case had submitted their particular budget proposals 9 months before, even under respondents' rule, we would have been required to file the suit. So from a budgetary planning perspective, the timing date of June 30th, 2019 is kind of meaningless for budgetary purposes. So the court should move beyond laches and get to the merits of this case. As to the merits, Mr. Roth said several times that you start with the text of the constitutional amendment and follow where it leads. And notice how he began that. You start with the constitutional text. You don't necessarily end with the constitutional text. It is the starting point, but then you do look and you see where it goes. And when that textual analysis by itself leads to unreasonable or absurd results, like it does here, then you reject that interpretation because it's the wrong interpretation that's inconsistent with the intent of the amendment, which is what you should be looking to do here. A date is the same point in time no matter how it's represented, whether it's represented in letters or digits. It's the same exact thing. So respondents want you to believe that there should be one rule that the governor can't use a partial veto on December 31st, 2018, if it's spelled out entirely in letters, but a different rule if it's spelled out in letters and in digits, as it was here. There is no common sense basis to draw a distinction. A date is a date is a date. It is the same point in time. This court has already basically said that same thing in Cub when it was looking at the write-in veto, when it said yes. This was a particular write-down veto that happened to be spelled out in digits, written down in digits. But if letters were used, that would have been the same exact result. The governor still has the write-in veto. They made no distinction between digits and letters, despite the 1990 amendment specifically saying letters alone. It took a substance over form approach, which is precisely what we're advocating that you apply in this instance. There is a distinction to be made, as Chief Justice, as you recognize, between dollars and non-dollars. And you're absolutely right. We are not suggesting that the governor no longer has the power to exercise the digit veto with respect to dollars, whether those be appropriation dollars or non-appropriation dollars. You can still exercise the digit veto there. What we're saying is that you can't exercise the digit veto after the 1990 amendment because that's what the 1990 amendment was intended to block. Vanna White vetoes. And this court has said in Cub that a Vanna White veto, it doesn't just involve letters. It can involve numbers, too. I think that's at page 492 in Cub. So take a look at that. We're not twisting ourselves into knots trying to make this distinction. The court itself has already made the distinction. We are not writing on a blank slate. We're asking the court to take the next logical step from its existing precedent. What we're asking the court to do is enforce the 1990 amendment as the people of this state intended for it to apply. You shouldn't require the citizens of this state to go back and go through the constitutional amendment process all over again simply to make clearer what they already intended to prohibit in the first place. If this court doesn't act right now, the gamesmanship between the legislative and executive branches will continue, and this court will be faced with more cases. This court should step in now, address it, end the constitutional jockeying. We ask that you hold these vetoes unconstitutional. Thank you. You're muted. You're muted.
Thank you. I thought I took it off. Okay. New technology for all of us, including me, that's for sure. Thank you both very much. I think the arguments were well done. I thought your briefing was exceptionally good, and the issues are tremendously interesting. So thank you very much. We are going to adjourn now, and we'll be back in session at 1:30 for our third case of the day. So we are adjourned.